Gunk.
Congratulations! You're listening to Congratulations Pine Tree, the Bay's number one arts and culture podcast with me, Kay Rhodes.
And me, Maysoon Wazwaz.
And we're here having an interview. First time in a long time. Let's see how it goes.
Hasn't been that long.
It's been a little while.
Summer.
We are speaking to curator and educator Elizabeth Thomas.
Oh. Hello.
What is a curator?
What is a curator?
What is a curator's role?
I often try to explain this to my undergrad students. So if you could put it in those terms, that'd be great.
I am also teaching people what a curator is at the moment, which is not so easy. If you read anything, it makes it more complicated than before you started reading. There's lots of different kinds of curators. Primarily, I have been the kind of curator that produces new projects with artists. So it is not necessarily the traditional role of the curator in maybe caring for a collection, doing academic research and writing about that collection and making exhibitions in an institution that way, although I certainly have done that. I don't know how to explain what I do because sometimes you're the producer director of a project working with an artist. Sometimes you're like the production assistant. Sometimes you're the key grip, the Foley person. You know, it really ranges depending on where you're working and what you're doing. But mostly I like to think about the curator as the person who is within the institution, best friend of the artist in terms of trying to make as many things possible for them and advocating for them, while at the same time within the institution sort of having to be mindful of the institution's desires and its goals and to try and think about how things make sense in those places and why things make the most sense in a particular moment, in a particular institution, in a particular city, and what the project can be that can maximize those things for both sides. So a project is never undertaken just because I think it's cool, much as many people think that's what curators do. But it's usually thinking a lot about what an institution is and its DNA and sort of what moment it's in and the world at large. This is making sound far more grandiose.
No, I love it. Very coherent.
If I could write an algorithm for it, I would. But I like to think about it before our recent trendy AI and machine learning moment in the art world. I used to talk about it as an algorithm, right? Because you're factoring in all these different aspects of the work and the nature of the work and the amount of money you have to spend and the amount of resources you have to apply to something, the availability of an artist, their willingness to imagine something big, and then the institution's capacity to tolerate being pushed a bit. Because I don't think there's a project I've ever worked on that didn't involve asking an institution to either live up to its ethics and ideas of itself or to adjust a little bit, let's say.
Mm-hmm. Have you had times where the institution's interests or whatever they want to do is in conflict with the artist's plan? Or
oh, for sure.
And then how? What's the craziest time of that?
Okay. Well, I am trying to think of the craziest time of that. But I mean, I think that happens all the time. And then you as a curator are best served if you're adept at navigating these situations by being able to like talk to various parties, be they funders, be they the administration, be they the facilities people at your institution, in ways that make them understand that you're looking out for their best interests while you're doing this thing that they may think is crazy, mm-hmm. right? I was talking about it with a bunch of young curators the other day, is allyship, like building this sort of allyship within an institution, which is like, I know I'm asking you a lot in terms of what you normally do here at XYZ institution in terms of trying to spread the potential, you know, which sometimes it's shocking. That's as simple as like asking for a brochure to be produced in a more economical and fast fashion, which can seem like you're asking for the world if that's the habituation an institution has, right? Mm-hmm. So it can be something as simple as that or crazy, like being able to drill holes into ceilings and floors and walls everywhere, right? Which was actually easier than getting the brochure to be read. Oh my God. Because it really depends on the people who are there and how much they're willing to play with you in these things, and how much they're willing to understand what those changes and what those sort of aberrations from the norm within institutions can produce and can make possible. And, you know, I think there's a way in which people need to feel like it's worth it, and it's your job and the artist's job, but I think your job as the person in the institution being paid to shepherd a project to make people understand why it's worth it.
I wanted to ask if you could, for our listeners, talk specifically about kind of the difference between like a project and exhibition.
In my career, I've worked in encyclopedic institutions and in contemporary only big museums with collections, and in smaller scale places like in the Bay Area, smaller scale museum like the Berkeley Art Museum, or a larger scale museum, but one with a small contemporary profile like the Fine Arts Museums, the De Young and the Legion of Honor, and then also in a lot of public contexts more lately. Mm-hmm. And so exhibitions are usually taking place within the context of institutions within four or more walls. Mm-hmm. And, you know, more often than not, they do include objects, but not always. And then a project for me, a lot of times the exhibitions I've done are just one project, like with Matrix at Berkeley. Oftentimes we were just producing one project as a single exhibition. I would say most time exhibitions have more than one artwork, whether it's physical or not, in them. And then there are some things that are massive projects, very large scale projects that I've done that are not taking place inside of institutions and that are produced with organizations, but really kind of live in the world in ways that people don't necessarily equate them with the institution mm-hmm. that produced them. And those are really sort of, they feel like projects that are unmoored from a particular ideological or physical context, so that people are just sort of seeing them in the world without necessarily knowing who put them there.
Mm-hmm. Like what?
Like what? Sorry, that sounded so mysterious. For several years, I was working in Philadelphia with a group called Mural Arts, Philadelphia mm-hmm. Mural Arts, which has an incredibly long and storied legacy producing what one would consider more traditional muralism, you know, mm-hmm. much like the background in muralism that exists here in San Francisco, except that this is a city affiliated and somewhat city funded institution started by a woman named Jane Golden, who really is the one person force behind this all, who both started it many, many years ago as an artist, who I think actually trained at Stanford, but as an artist and as a person who was very interested in social justice. So anyway, this program has lasted for a very long time. And over the years, they've experimented a bit with what they have done, not to say that the muralism and the more traditional community work they've been doing isn't valuable, but really wanting to expand the vocabulary of public art in Philadelphia, and also kind of find other contexts in which the mural work and the community investment work they do can be seen. And I should say that Philadelphia is not like San Francisco, because Philadelphia has Pew and other great...
Pew Research?
Pew, the foundation, mm-hmm. in general.
Do they also do polling?
That's why
I know about Pew. Yes,
probably, I hear about that on the radio all the time also. Yeah, Pew... they have Center for Arts and Heritage, which funds to a really generous degree. I'm going to say $250,000 for a single project.
Wow. Damn.
For arts projects and also heritage projects.
Hmm. Okay.
I don't quite know what constitutes a heritage project.
Is it maybe like cultural things that aren't art things?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of times they were like storytelling projects.
Yeah.
Connected to history museums and stuff like that. Well, that's the thing, is to me,
I would think of that as art.
The same thing, but yeah. I understand that there's a different language around contemporary art than there is in that world.
I mean, maybe the thing is that then, like, a contemporary artist who's just making contemporary art that's unrelated to, like, some heritage-type mm-hmm. culture mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. can't apply for the heritage grants,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And then there's special money yeah. for things that are, you know.
And then they also have performance and other strange. Just to say that when they do fund things, there's, like, 10 or more projects a year that are funded to that degree in the Philadelphia landscape.
Well, that's what's going on in Philly. Yeah. I keep wondering why everyone's moving there.
Step up, San Francisco.
For sure.
Where are those foundations at? I mean, Rainin has stepped in to attempt to shift the public art discourse here.
Yeah.
For sure. Although I don't have personal experience with them. But so anyway, so for Michael Rakowitz, which mm-hmm. is the person I made together we made a performance and radio program with the mural folks in Philadelphia. He was someone that I brought to them to actually stretch the notion of public and to stretch the notion of the form, so that instead of a painting, we had a performance and a radio program. Instead of a street corner or a wall, we had the public airwaves, and we had this temporary occupation of Independence Mall. And so I was able to convince them and others that that was consistent with their way of being, partially because they were just so open to this. And I was there because Pew funded that curatorial residency in the first place, to have people come in and really challenge them.
Right.
Michael had, at that point, already for 12 years or more, been working around the reality of the Iraq War and the United States' relationship to Iraq. He is Iraqi American, although he's never been to Iraq. I think he was on Iraqi soil technically once when he was at the Iraqi mission in the United States.
Oh,
the idea of like when you're in a embassy, although it couldn't be called an embassy for some reason. But in any case, he's never been to Iraq, but has worked with Iraqis and Iraq War veterans now for, I think it's like 15 years now. But so I invited him to Philadelphia, knowing that Mural Arts had already worked a lot with refugees, and knowing that there was at least some population of Iraqi refugees who had recently been arriving in Philadelphia. And then that Warrior Writers, which is this amazing organization headquartered out of Philadelphia, was there working with Iraq War vets, not just Iraq War vets, but a lot of Iraq War vets, already working to give people space and time and a public context sometimes for sharing their own writing, a private context sometimes for it only as well, as a means of sharing, but also healing themselves. And so because of that, I knew Philadelphia could be fruitful for Michael as a place. And he started doing research and found out about a broadcaster who had been living in Philadelphia for a few years at that point. And like everyone we met, every single Iraqi we met, was displaced from Iraq because of death threats and or actual kidnapping. So every single person I met had some incredibly complicated, maddening, saddening, terrifying story to tell about their journey away from home. Bajat Abdullah Wahid, I say that probably 90% correct. He and his wife, Haifa Abdul Qadir, were both living in Philadelphia in a tiny one-bedroom apartment. Were both broadcasters. He had been described to me as the Walter Cronkite of Baghdad, in that he had been on TV for decades as a news announcer. That's what he would always say instead of a newscaster. And then also was the person to teach other young broadcasters to be news announcers. And Haifa had worked there briefly before she married him, hated him so much that she quit her first day. And then I think he came a year later to her house to ask that she marry him.
Fucking dudes, no, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, I know. She's amazing. Michael is one of those artists who works from research and works from reality and yet creates these things that seem impossible and unreal, and supremely poetic through things that are actually true in the world. So in this case, Bajat became the heart of the project, and the idea became to put Bajat back on the airwaves somehow. And then to use a radio program as a means to aggregate the experiences and talents of the whole group of people that we were able to work with in Philadelphia, which meant that some, for some people, that was straightforward writing and performing. For some people, that was their superhero they had been working on called Dolphin Man, being adapted into a skit with costumes. For some people, that was singing music that they had recorded both in Iraq and the United States to finish an album through both recording processes. For other people, it was reading Shakespeare. Then there was like a group dance that we did about making kuba because we needed to find a way to let all the people who didn't speak English well enough and were afraid to speak have a way to perform too. And so this articulated itself as a performance to launch the project on Independence Mall right next to the Liberty Bell. And we had this amazing response from them where they never questioned it. Pre-Trump, I should say, these conversations, but they never questioned it. And they saw very much that Independence Mall was where new Americans should be, and that this was a project about new Americans and Americans who had served their country. So no challenge from them, warm embrace. And then we also had an amazing musical director who was not Iraqi, but an expert in Middle Eastern music who helped us adapt all kinds of American music with Arabizing of the melodies and the arrangements. And then he assembled a small band that played during the show. And then he made all the music for the radio program. And then in the end, Michael kind of narrated this American lifestyle.
Sure. of course.
Or This Iraqi Death, which was one of our alternate titles for the project.
Yeah.
That and Wait, Wait, Don't Shoot Me. Riffing
Damn.
On all the NPR.
The Iraqi News Quiz Show.
Yes, we did want to call it A Desert Home Companion, and that was working with, but then we ended up being distributed by the Public Radio Exchange, which distributes Garrison Keillor, and therefore we could not.
They were like, nope.
I'm told he does not have a sense of humor about licensing and copyright.
Yep. Is that still available for people to listen to?
Yes. Sorry, I did not even say the name of the project in the first place. It is called now Radio Silence, after all those possible names. And it is a podcast that is still available. It aired as a radio program as well, but people can find that on iTunes, Stitcher, anywhere your favorite podcast, such as PPT. Congratulations Pine Tree, can
be found. I'll put a link to it also in our show
and notes. Then there's also a website where we collected a lot of documentation and writing. Dina Chalabi, who many of us in San Francisco know as a wonderful curator and writer, wrote a series of letters to Michael, who she hadn't met, about Iraq, a place she also hasn't been, I believe, as an Iraqi British person living in the U.S. now. And Francis Richard also wrote something, another local writer and educator. So the website is really the best place to go, because then you get a little extra context and you can see there was a Facebook Live of the performance that one can see in addition to radio episodes.
Do you have a sense of how many listeners you had, or since it's radio, like how you were able to kind of
There were a couple
get
of
the word out, I guess, even,
things or that happened with that project that contributed to some fits and starts in it. Not the least of which, while we were in high gear, Bajat, the broadcaster, became ill and was hospitalized and then ultimately passed away.
Oh my God, I'm so sorry.
Yeah, he was really an amazing person, and the way he died, of course, I don't want to reduce it to these poetics, but the way he died ultimately was so poetic and telling of the entire project and of the entire situation in Iraq, which is that he had lung problems. And so he ended up with a tracheostomy and losing his voice before he passed away. Right. And then ultimately was on life support and then passed away. So Radio Silence as a title comes from that, and comes from Michael's kind of casting about for a way to reframe this project that had this person at the center, who, as he said, the host had become a ghost, and was really an homage to him, but also a way of thinking about the United States and Iraq and diasporas and the ways in which voices are lost but can be reconstructed and aggregated together, right? So, that happened, and then there was another unavoidable delay. So some of the momentum we would have had for it was a little bit curtailed. I mean, I know we broadcast on many channels, and we worked at this great nonprofit also in Philadelphia, Prometheus Radio Network, who were responsible for several acts that made it possible for the low-par FM spectrum to be opened up for public use. So they sued the federal government, then they pivoted to helping people make applications for low-par FM licenses, and then they pivoted again to helping people build transmitters in order to affect low-par FM stations. It really was like a very homegrown effort in Philadelphia with all these amazing organizations. So with them, we worked to place it on a lot of grassroots radio stations.
That's great,
So were you, as a curator, like connecting all these pieces together of like finding the nonprofits and finding the people in.
Yeah. I mean, I think in that role that you kind of are, without the evil part, masterminding, hopefully without the evil part, you know, Michael was coming in and out of town, but also less able to be in town than I was. At that point, I didn't have a full-time job here in San Francisco, so I was traveling back and forth and able to be on the ground more to make some of these connections. And so it was always in conversation with him and with Mural Arts. But yes, that was part of my role, was sort of figuring out, like, here's the landscape of Philadelphia. What can we do with what's here? And finding the right parties to work with. And then we had a couple of different great production people who lived in Philadelphia worked on it over the course of its many years. I think it was like a 5-year process because of these fits and starts. So while I didn't literally like make the contract with PRX, you know, and we had great people who were handling all of those details, I was sort of working to figure out what relationships we could build and maintaining communications with this large group of people that we had come to be working with in Philadelphia, the Iraqis and the veterans and the organizations and the different nonprofits working with them, among many other kinds of groups. Yeah.
What is your email organization system?
Oh, it's terrible. What? I'm the worst. I think I have something like 492,000 unread emails.
What?
In my Gmail. I could pull up my phone.
But do you read them and then just mark them as unread?
No, I mean,
why would you do that?
Honestly, most of those are spam and or eflux.
Why do you not delete? I have my eflux go to a separate filter.
Me too. I don't.
And then I just never read them and delete them once every 3 months.
I'm not a person who's good at maintenance of things, because I'm usually doing stuff. So I don't often go through and clear out and organize the way I should. That's why. So I don't like daily.
You don't got a color code or do you have a special label for it? Like if you're doing a massive project like
you
that.
You must have a folder for your
you
massive
project. You don't have
project.
Like a star system, a label, nothing.
I'm
not even a folder?
Searching.
Just searching your inbox.
How do you manage your fucking archive?
I don't have one.
Wow.
Not really. I mean, also I've worked in so many different places that I lost my archives when I would leave places sometimes because it wouldn't occur to me, or I lost my email at various points through different events at work, like servers going down or whatever. So I don't have an archive, really.
What's going to happen over there at the Berkeley Art Museum?
Without Larry?
Who are they going to get in to be the new director?
I do not know, but it's a plum job, so I'm sure they'll have their choice of many people. You know,
do you think it'll be somebody from outside the Bay Area?
I don't actually have any theories on it because, you know, there's only one or two people in the Bay Area that I can even imagine would be right for it.
Mm-hmm.
And
who are they? Me and Maysoon?
Yes. Only if they'll do a job share.
Can we be co-directors?
I would fucking hate to have to do any of that.
Yes. So it's possible that it could be somebody from here, right? It's also such a plum job that I think they'll have lots and lots and lots of applicants.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. I don't know what search firm they're working with, but I'm sure it's already underway. And the transition, I'm sure like the timing had something to do with when Larry's pension was vesting after 20 years or something, and it's planned in advance. So I'm sure it'll all be a very orderly and well-organized transition as far as these go.
This is back to Michael Rakowicz really quick. I did read that you guys hosted a dinner party using Saddam Hussein's china.
That was not me. I wish it was me.
And that is shocking to me.
That was Michael. And that
was it part of this project?
No,
it was
totally
different.
Totally different.
Okay, sorry.
He is so amazing that he managed to get like the Iraqi government to unwittingly collaborate with him on a project. So he
loved it so much.
So he did this project, I think Creative Time commissioned it many years ago, and it was
big bucks.
Artists working with fancy restaurants in New York to make dishes. And so it was all kinds of people making all kinds of dishes. And then of course Michael's is the one that takes on international geopolitics.
Yeah.
And so he managed to get dishes from Saddam Hussein's palace that were looted. And he bought them, I think, from like some contractor on eBay, and then also maybe from some military person on eBay. I'm not sure. And he'll show you like the eBay listings for it. And so he got this china, and that was given to the restaurant to be used to serve a dish of lamb with Iraqi date syrup, which is Iraqi dates. And Iraqi date syrup is an incredibly symbolically rich and also sort of phenomenologically evocative ingredient in Iraqi cooking. And I think there's something like 1,000 different kinds of dates or something. And so it's an incredibly important food in Iraq. So, so this piece got some press coverage. I can't remember exactly who it was, but somebody from the Iraqi government got wind of it and wanted to confiscate the plates and repatriate them to Iraq. Oh. So I don't think it was the ambassador who literally did that, but I do know they flew back on a plane with the ambassador to Iraq. So whoever this was asked for the plates to be repatriated. And so there was like a meeting in a conference room at Creative Time where they came to pick up the plates, the Iraqi government. And then that's, I think, when Michael ended up on Iraqi soil technically, because he of course followed the people who took the plates back to wherever they were going, to some townhouse somewhere where the Iraqi mission, I think that's what it's called instead of embassy, is located, and then like went inside to talk to them about yes. So that already got New York Times coverage, like for the initial piece. And then Rachel Maddow did a piece about this return and the unwitting collaboration of the Iraqi government. Yeah.
One of the things that listeners to the show may remember when we talk about you often, it's you giving really intense comment at different public events around
Have you spoken of me on the podcast before? Oh, no.
You really, you really
not to
went,
you, but of you, yes.
You
yes.
went hard at the Will Brown town hall at SFAI when they had just let go of Katie Hood Morgan.
Yes.
Just go ahead and just go off.
Oh, I mean, I don't. you know.
What do we do? What should we do?
I'm not sure.
Ideally,
I do think Frank,
if you had to give orders,
I mean, I think it's
marching orders
complicated, but I think Frank Schmigel at Fort Mason is going to be attempting to take on some of that public practice here in the Bay Area as he's sort of sorting out what Fort Mason can best be used for as a venue and as a place where you get both this kind of incidental public audience that's there and a deliberate audience for art specific things. You know, he's just beginning to experiment with the ways in which that will work there. And I have a lot of hope and faith in that as a place that could produce some interesting things for sure. You know, I've never understood why YBCA doesn't have a better relationship to Yerba Buena Park or to downtown in producing things. It's something that their rhetoric certainly would suggest they'd be interested in, but even those like weird festivals of blinky lights and like bad seating that they did on Market Street.
Their prototype festival?
Yeah, sorry, haven't happened in many years. Like, let's just ignore the people living on the street. Let's make a nicer place.
Not just ignore them, but
for
like
for people to sit.
Yeah, like call, like, I remember going to like the info session for that where they're like, everyone apply to this. And then they'd have like different like municipal people talk about their places. And they would talk about like people experiencing homelessness as like, this is one of the obstacles to you as an artist. Like, think about this because it's going to be a problem. Isn't that nuts?
It's nuts.
Make sure you don't have anywhere someone could sleep or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, those specific conditions of San Francisco are, I feel like, not, they can't be solved by public art. Let's just say it. They can't be solved by public art.
Yeah, for sure.
But that doesn't mean we couldn't also be doing better at creating public art experiences for people. Yeah. We should also be building navigation centers and doing all the things that the city says it's going to do to support people who are houseless. You know, the city here, there's great people who work in the Arts Commission, and the poster projects, oftentimes really interesting choices are made about that for the posters that go on Market Street. You know, it's just that they're just posters. So they're a sort of limit to the effect they can have on space, right? Yeah. And all of that. And then now we have this world of public art commissioning for percent for art construction projects that is starting to bloom in San Francisco, right? We've seen the Jim Campbell piece and now the Olafur Eliasson piece, and there's going to be more and more of those that are happening under the auspices of private construction and management, but that will feel like public art, I guess. And that is one way the city is having public art. I mean, I know the Arts Commission is commissioning a ton of stuff for the airport and for other places where they have the mandate to produce the Percent for Art stuff. Mm-hmm. But I just don't think it would take an organization who was willing to navigate interdepartmental and sort of different kinds of partnerships. I know that Eveline Joannou, who was Ho Han Ru's partner and who was trying to do that here for a while also living in Rome, was coming back here to try and develop a public art kind of agency.
Yeah.
It's something I thought about, how to maybe create something that could be parasitic with existing organizations in order to produce individual projects with different organizations. But I sort of lacked the individual fundraising capacity to do that because I don't have, it only takes one billionaire in your pocket, but I don't have one.
You don't have one. Yeah, exactly.
It's a joke. Many of us have. It just takes one rogue billionaire.
Maybe yeah. We can get you one from the podcast. So if any billionaires are listening, and you want to
support,
I can
do great things with your money. Yes.
Boom. There you go.
I won't make you any money, but I can spend it well. Yes.
Experiences are the new money.
Oh, I like that.
Yes. Well, that is true. The experience economy has been here for many years in the culture, the culture world.
There is, what is it? Dorca's public art.
Dorca Keen. Keen on art.
She's a person.
She's a person.
I mean, that was like
sorry.
Three things in the alleys
Wasn't
downtown.
That something? Right next to SF MoMA.
Right next to SF MoMA that I think, I mean,
a little
for what it was, great. Hasn't continued. And she's sort of the primary person who's doing all the corporate Percent for Art project development. So she's responsible for the Olafur Eliasson and the Jim Campbell, both, actually. She's kind of got a monopoly on that world of public art commissioning here. She's also responsible for those, I think, the pianos tumbling off the side of a building somewhere.
No. How do you know what's good or bad?
Whoa! Kate. Well, one Christmas, my brother got me, I don't know where he found them, these stickers that just said art inside of that, like, circle with the slash through it. No.
Yeah.
International symbol for no. Mm-hmm. And he told me that I could then use that to just walk around
and slap it on the work you didn't
decide
like.
What's not art.
Oh my god.
Not just that it was bad, but that it was not art.
Exactly.
You're like, not art.
Boop. Yeah. I
shit, that's hard.
Never did that.
Good, I'm glad.
They're in some box somewhere. I feel like for me, it's like the question of free speech, right? Which is like, even if I hate your speech, I will fight for it to be free. Mm-hmm. So even if I think work is terrible, I still think it should exist.
Sure.
Why?
Because I don't want there to be a world where one person decides what's good and bad. Because that is not possible. Mm-hmm. That things will be universally liked. And also the things that are universally liked are usually the most boring things. Because to be universally liked, right? I will say, and I've had this conversation with many people, that it's like, is it the moment? Is it just that we're all of a certain age and have been doing this for like 20 plus years now and therefore are jaded? Like, what is it? Many people I speak to seem to think less and less things are wonderful, more and more things are uninspiring. And I'm not sure what to chalk that up to. I mean, I certainly feel that way for myself of the experiences that I have. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was just at, and this is going to sound like I'm plugging it, which I'm not, because it took me months to get there. But I was at the Legion of Honor and going to see the Alexandra Singh exhibition that my former colleague Claudia Schmuckli curated, which has like literally gotten no coverage and no visibility. So even I forgot it was happening, even though I
haven't heard of it. Yeah.
Was working there for a long time with Claudia and knew all about it. Anyway, this project, which I know was initially conceived to be a much larger intervention along the lines of the Sarah Lucas and Urs Fischer kind of takeovers of the Legion, was scaled back somewhat in this particular installation. But I was there with curator friends of mine, and we actually were like running around the room, like actually delighted. Aww. Looking at things and being surprised by them and trying to get different views on the work. And, you know, it was of the experiences I've had in the past 6 months, I'll say, one of the few that actually felt like something great. And, you know, part of that had to do with the company that I was with, two other really smart people. Yeah. And so we got to run around and think with each other. And also, it's like super high production value film that was produced that Lord knows the Legion of Honor did not pay for that in its entirety. And the money had to come from somewhere else to produce that scale of a production. I mean, really the most gorgeous set design and art direction of an art piece I've seen in years. We were all thinking it was like back to the Matthew Barney days when there was endless money from galleries produce things, right? And not that it's slick that way, but that it just is so obviously resourced. Hmm. But a beautiful film, and then this sort of engaging and transformative kind of visual experience. I don't really want to ruin it for anybody by talking too much about what it is, but all three of us were like, remarking about the degree to which that differed from most of our art viewing experiences. Mm-hmm. I have to say that's not that is truly unusual for me these days to feel that way, to be excited by something. And I hope it's not some like consequence of age and I'm just destined to be less and less excited every year by fewer and fewer things. But it did remind me how amazing it can feel when you're actually excited by something, right? Yeah. And that's part of the reason we all do this, for as little money and as much frustration and everything else that goes unsaid about what is difficult about doing this for a living or for an avocation, whether it's paid or not, right? I don't know how to make more of those things happen. I like to think I try to make those things happen. That I think about projects in a way, and part of my shift away from wanting to do more traditional exhibitions, and as I joke, moving things around rooms, is that wasn't doing it for me anymore. And so that's part of the shift I undertook to doing more public projects, and then going into the role at the De Young that I took, which was sort of experimental and sort of unstable, but it was a thing that allowed me to do a retrospective with Anna Halperin, to have like 7 different events of different intensities or different audience sizes, different levels of participation that could produce all these different experiences for people. I think it's, of course, easier to think about how live experience with live performance has a better chance of affecting people more deeply that way.
Yeah.
But I also think it's a place where it can go so horribly, horribly, horribly wrong.
Yeah, that's also true.
That I don't know that it is more frequent in those kind of contexts than in, you know, gallery situations. I don't know. I mean, do you all feel motivated? I mean, I was really excited when I went into Sahar Khoury's room at
Sika. Incredible.
The energy around those rooms and around those people and around that work that night felt real. And to me, it was like more energy than I felt at a Sika in a while, for sure. And I would hesitate to say that I don't think that just comes from who these people are as people. And it's not just about the fact that we all love them, you know, or we all love one or more of them, you know. I think it transcends that kind of familiarity. I think this work transcends that kind of familiarity. I mean, I think the curators were like almost in tears giving their...
They were.
Their talks.
Their remarks, yeah.
Yeah.
Do you want to do like or don't like?
How many passes do I have available?
0.
Okay.
No, you can pass. Or you can say ambivalent.
Okay.
Okay, like or don't like. The sculpture that is now being taken down that goes is the overpass on 80. Do you know this? In Berkeley. It is the University Avenue overpass where there are 2 public sculptures. One of people doing like recreational activities and one of people protesting.
I remember not liking that.
Either side, right?
It's going down. It's being taken down. Where do you stand?
I don't like it. I don't necessarily think it should be taken down.
Oh, okay. Fair enough. I think their reasoning for it was that it was too much money to maintain.
That is the problem with public art, I have to say. One of the problems with this idea of permanent public art.
This kind of public art.
Okay, how about the George Washington High School mural?
Oh, gosh. Whew. I've avoided having to have an opinion about this for so long. I mean, I'm so torn because I just feel like listen to the people who have more investment than I do.
Yeah.
Which That's is the how kids I feel about and it. Artists who are in a similar position and they contradict each other. And so I don't know what to say.
I would go with the students.
I do, however, feel like there could be a way, and I understand why the students don't want this, but there are ways to cover something and not destroy it, mm-hmm. right? And I understand the students not wanting to see it. Absolutely. I do not understand the need to destroy it.
What else do we see?
We got the Klaus Oldenburg Cupid's arrow.
Oh, yeah. Cupid's span.
Uh-huh. Sorry, yeah. Over what, on Embarcadero. You know that one?
What's the happening big, with big it? Grape, nothing. Do
oh,
you
do
like
I just
it or
like
not?
It or
yes
not like
or
it?
No? Like it, not like it.
It's not my favorite Oldenburg, but I like it.
Oh, damn. Okay, that's okay. a surprise
How about the
to
lights
me.
On the goddamn bridge?
The largest stereo equalizer in the world.
Woo! Yes, that one.
Snap.
So I'll take that as a don't like.
I yeah. agree.
That is my greatest disappointment about San Francisco public art, is that it all has to blink.
Okay. So then where? How about the top of the motherfucking Millennium
Salesforce.
Tower? Or yeah,
Salesforce
Tower.
I love Jim Campbell.
Yeah.
And yet that piece does not work. I'm
what would
sorry.
You put up there?
I would question the need to put a thing at the top of the building.
So far away.
That's a very Liz Thomas answer.
I mean, I know from reading things that were written about it that the Salesforce CEO or whoever, Mark Benioff, and the architect or whoever the people were involved in commissioning it were interested in something that would be married with the building. So the idea of doing something at that scale came out of those conversations. But yeah, I'm not sure that it just doesn't work. You can't tell what's going on. Like, it doesn't read.
You can't see it well enough most of the time.
Yeah. And then
there's times where it just doesn't seem like there's anything going on.
Exactly.
Like it glitches all the time.
I wish they would rotate it every month.
Yeah.
Get a new video artist to make something for it.
Can I add one in?
Totally.
Please.
Post-commodity, public art. Sound cannon being shot yes. from the SFAI bell tower to downtown near the sinking.
That's the Millennium
Tower.
I always get that in the Salesforce.
Is that what
they're?
Is that what the show is?
Yes,
they're supposed to do awesome. It until the building is either fixed or destroyed.
Yes,
love it. I love that.
So hopefully SFAI will be around as long as that is. For one of those states to happen.
Say a prayer.
Yes. That piece, sure. It's a public artwork, non-physical public artwork, 5 minutes a day, as I understand it, or so, coming out at 5 p.m., targeting a very specific audience of workers near the Millennium Tower. And I'm a little unclear of exactly how the sounds are being produced, but it's like somehow electronic and algorithmic and somehow related to ASMR and Ugh. Has the, I didn't hear any voices though. There was no like, pss, 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 pss.
Is this what I've been hearing? Is like,
what is the sound?
Birds.
No, it only opened on Friday.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So it's
the sound sort of being projected to the Millennium Tower from
yes,
SFAI.
Correct. From the top of the tower
correct.
At SFAI.
From the campanile.
Correct.
Whatever.
Yeah, we don't call it that.
No, okay.
The bell tower.
That's a Mills word.
It's also a Berkeley word.
It's a Berkeley word, the campanile.
I thought at Berkeley they called it the campanile.
Well, campanile would be the proper time pronunciation, but I think campanile.
If there's not an E on the end, it's campanile, okay?
There is an E.
Ravioli.
Anyhow.
Okay.
In any case, I think that's a brilliant public artwork. And I was a little afraid when they were first working on it, since some of their music/sound work can be aggressive, that it would be aggressive. But it is, in fact, instead meant as an ameliorative gesture. And it's supposed to be a relaxing sound being sent down to the people in the shadow of the Millennium Tower.
Oh, damn.
Yes.
I love that.
I love that piece. I love them. Cade Twist and Cristobal Martinez. Yes.
You're from Wisconsin?
I am from Wisconsin.
Where in Wisconsin?
From a city called Monona, which is basically landlocked by Madison. Wisconsin. Mm.
Do you have any plans to be back there at all for the 2020 election?
I am no longer registered in Wisconsin, so...
do you have any info for listeners? If you want to go to Pennsylvania, you only have to be there for the 60 days of the run-up to the election.
Yeah, I don't know that.
Do you want us to figure that out for you?
It could be like a little residency.
Yeah, I feel like I shouldn't say this, but I feel like Wisconsin has learned its lesson, perhaps.
Knock on wood.
And I'm all for all those different efforts that people are making to support liberal candidates in smaller districts to shift state politics, and all the efforts that are being made to redraw the gerrymandered lines.
Big time.
I think that's a critical space. And I cannot believe that Republican operatives had the foresight, however many years ago it was. Wasn't it some like 25-year-old kid who had that idea of like, let's take all these smaller districts and get all the lines redrawn?
What's his name? Gerrymander?
No, it wasn't. But it was like some crazy story, like a 25-year-old kid had this idea like that we can do this thing that no one will be noticing while we're doing it and it'll have tremendous effect. And lo and behold,
here it is.
It did.
Yeah. Would you encourage people, particularly retirees with real intense housing security, to move from the Bay Area to Wisconsin to canvass and swing the election and vote there?
Well, someone can stay with my parents, probably. So
okay, so that's an open offer. Give us a call, 419-351-6606. You can tweet us at Pine Tree Podcast, or you can email us, congratulationspinetree@gmail.com, and we'll hook you
up. We'll connect you to
with,
Liz.
The Thomases.
Family?
The Thomases, yes.
Yes, fantastic.
And I have old friends whose... parents are involved in Democratic politics in the state and can put you to best use.
Fantastic. Yeah. Get your walking shoes ready.
So you could probably get a few, maybe like five people out to Wisconsin. What do you think?
Hundreds. If we only get 400.
We can house maybe about five people based on Liz's recommendations.
I don't know. I could get some kind of couch surfing thing going with people there. Okay. Sure.
Thank you.
So 100 people.
Yes. 400 people.
One of my friends runs some kind of tech incubator co-working space. Yeah. I'm sure people tech can people sleep under the desks, right?
Yeah. Tech oh, yeah.
At
go.
Night.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, go Packers.
Go Big Red.
And Badgers.
Uh-huh.
Good.
And cheese curds, just saying.
And...
cheese heads.
May cheese curds rain down on us all. Okay. Okay. Thank
fried
you.
Fried cheese curds.
Absolutely. Oh, I never had those. Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Liz.
Thomas, for speaking with us today. And woo-hoo. As always,
congratulations.
And listeners, we'll be talking to you from the bridge.
To the other bridge.
To the island in between. This has been
Congratulations Pine Tree.